Chapter 10. The Complex Character. Complexity through Antagonism. Stoic philosophers, beginning around 300 BC, taught that the gods predetermine life. Olympians know all of mankind's future events, but hide them until they happen. Stoics called this force fate, and this belief lives on today. When, for example, a tragic accident takes a child's life, his parents often tell the TV cameras that they bow to God's will. Epicurean philosophers took the opposite view. They held that what we mistake for a power outside ourselves is the work of a free will hidden within ourselves. Random events beyond human control may disrupt us, but our will-driven reactions determine the path life takes. The choices we make under these pressures shape our future. As Heraclitus put it, character is destiny. The latter belief seems more likely. An invisible force, as it were, does shape a character's life, but it emanates from within himself. As Carl Jung taught, the conscious mind lives on the edge of a volcano, and unless a character becomes aware of his subconscious impulses, life will always seem beyond control. Surprising things will always happen to him as if by fate. Picture two ships in a raging storm. One stays afloat, the other goes under. The same seas batter both. The difference is not luck, but who captains. As Cassius puts it in The Tragedy of Julius Caesar, the fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves, that we are underlings. As a young character comes of age, a perfect storm of external forces affects his sense of values. What is worth pursuing? What's foolish to pursue? When his subconscious reinforces his inclinations, they become beliefs. These convictions, rooted in his true character, guide him through this pattern. 1. Based on his beliefs, his core self determines the choices and actions he makes and takes. Conversely, his choices express his true character. 2. His choices under pressure shape his future, not only revealing who he is, but how he changes into who he becomes. 3. The more various the antagonisms in his life, the more diverse his choices. 4. The more diverse his choices, the more complex his nature, and thus the more dimensional, unpredictable, surprising, and ultimately revealing his reactions and actions. 5. His character, therefore, becomes only as multidimensional as the story's complex of antagonistic forces that conflict within him. Levels and qualities of conflict range from the physical, nature's powers spanning from the massive forces of the universe to microscopic diseases, to the social, demands of employment and citizenship, and personal, demands of intimate relationships, to the internal, the mind's conflicting desires. Let's work from the outermost to the innermost to see how levels of antagonism multiply dimensionality into a complex character. Physical conflicts. A story's outermost level of conflict embraces the four grand components of the physical world. 1. Natural environments and the powers they contain. From the human point of view, nature is as random as a tornado, as fierce as a wolf pack, and as morally indifferent as evolution. 2. Man-made environments and the systems they control. Civilizations were conceived with a moral as well as a practical purpose. We human beings, therefore, share responsibility for both the beauty of our creations and the ill effects of pollution, global warming, war, and all other man-made disasters. 3. Our bodily environment and its many maladies. The brain lives inside a trouble-prone beast. This body inflicts aggravations on the mind that range from illnesses to aging to an unfortunately shaped nose. These conflicts are partly random, partly predictable, partly indifferent, and partly self-inflicted. 4. Our temporal environment and its brevity. Time contains all that exists, and over time, it will erase all. Let's sketch out a characterization based on behaviors at the physical level only. A young man is a daredevil who ski jumps from frightening heights. If he buys trendy outfits he really can't afford, he enjoys provoking envy in the ski lodge spotlight. If he arrives for jump practice hours before sunup, then nervously glances at his watch until his coach arrives, he suffers from time anxiety. If he constantly calls his mother for advice, he lacks maturity. Put these traits together, and he becomes an athletic, hyper-impatient, self-absorbed, immature thrill-seeker. At this point, his multifaceted characterization prepares him only for a supporting role. To evolve him into a complex protagonist, we need to transform his traits into dimensions. As I just mentioned, when one trait consistently contradicts another, the tension between them fuses into a dimension. So let's take each of his traits, imagine its opposite, and see where that leads. If his vanity hides self-doubt, if PEDs fuel his athleticism, if the adrenaline rush that propels his death-defying stunts masks a mama's boy longing for a dead father, if his every leap off a ski jump is a mini-suicide, if his anxiousness only calms when he's in midair, he might earn a story of his own. Social conflicts. Now let's look at social structures and a character's struggles at this level of life. Massive institutions harden over time into hierarchies on a scale so great that the people in them feel little or no personal responsibility. These hierarchies shape human beings into the roles to be played, then organize them inside a pyramidal scheme in which the people at the bottom have no power, the people at the top have great power, and the people in the middle grab for power as they jostle up and down the chain of command. Stressful as these massive systems are, they couldn't exist unless the people in them welcomed their roles. Indeed, institutions raise us, educate us, support us, and mold the roles we play. As the documentarian Frederick Wiseman exposed in more than 40 film studies of institutions, those who reach an organization's pinnacle tend to be efficient, but callous. As a result, from governments, corporations, and militaries, to hospitals, monasteries, and families, institutions, to some degree, narrow their members into someone less than the ideal human being. The grand irony of civilization is that although social structures protect us from one kind of suffering, death by starvation, they inflict misery of another, begrudging obedience. And humanity has no alternative. We need institutions to progress us on the outer level while we pay the price on the inner level. The ideologies that govern institutions span a spectrum that runs from "I am my brother's keeper" to "every man for himself." At the "every man for himself" end of the spectrum sits predatory capitalism. This system exploits our innate drives for self-importance, wealth, and power. Sociopaths thrive in this environment. In the population as a whole, sociopaths constitute 1%. On Wall Street, 10%. At the "I am my brother's keeper" poll sit absolute governments and dictators claiming to care for their citizens but giving them no choice in what they get. Sociopaths feel equally at home here. In between these two extremes are meritocracies that promote people up the ladder of power based on hard work, intelligence, and achievement. Once in power, however, these elites pull the ladder up after them, turning their meritocracy into an oligarchy. In the United States, for example, wealthy white Protestant men wrote the Constitution, then created industries and universities. But at the same time, they built their power on slavery, Jim Crow, anti-Catholicism, anti-Semitism, anti-Hispanicism, and anti-feminism. Because institutions de-individualize, they cause people to do things they normally wouldn't. Would a normal person taunt a stranger into killing himself? No. But a study of suicides committed in public found that once onlookers gather, they often become a mob, a momentary institution working in unison to bait the guy on the ledge into jumping. Every year, during religious ceremonies and sporting events, panicking, out-of-control crowds of passionate, like-minded people trample each other to death. To cope with institutions, a character, beginning in childhood, straps on various social selves to guide his public interactions. Each social self has a set of traits designed to deal with the various institutions he faces. He does not chat with his professor in the same manner he talks with his rabbi, or the clerk at the DMV, or his boss at work, or his cohorts at QAnon, or his commanding officer in the National Guard. So, let's give a character a half a dozen traits based on the roles he plays when coping with stress and conflict within these institutions. 1. Humble when meeting his professor. 2. Shamed when confessing to his rabbi. 3. Obsequious while taking his DMV license renewal test. 4. Generous while helping his boss solve a problem. 5. Skeptical while conspiring about politics online. And 6. Frightened when yelled at by his commanding officer. These traits add up to a kind, shy, easily intimidated man, someone in need of the friends he finds in a chat room. This monochrome characterization may create a supporting role on the edge of events, but once again, to take him center stage, contradictions are needed to turn his traits into dimensions. Suppose the humble excuses he uses in his professor's office become bragging recitations that bore his classmates. Suppose his shame in his rabbi's office feeds a secret, perverse sex life. Suppose he fawns at the DMV, then drives off like a maniac. Suppose his generosity toward his boss reverses into stinginess with coworkers. Suppose his conspiracy theory cynicism stems from the gullible belief that the people in power actually know what they're doing. Suppose his fear of military authority unleashes a murderous fury on the battlefield. If we were to wrap a story around him that expresses these dimensions, he might carry a telling to a staggering climax. Personal conflicts. Public relationships value consequences. Personal relationships value intentions. When a person with social power chooses a course of action, outcome matters more than sincerity. When someone in a personal relationship takes action, sincerity matters more than outcome. We condemn an investor's financial mistakes, no matter his personal intentions. We forgive a lover's insult in hope he didn't mean it. Human beings suffer in social alienation, but thrive in close company. The difference between social and personal relationships is intimacy. What bonds family to family, friend to friend, lover to lover, are shared thoughts and feelings normally never revealed in public. The chemistry of intimacy takes two people beyond their social roles, co-workers, for example, to friendship and rapport. Depending on the personalities involved, of course, intimacy can be either joyful or painful. As the core self moves from childhood to adulthood, it develops its identity along a spectrum of experiences that runs from approving, intense, and multiple loving intimacies at one end to insulting, cold, and singularly cruel intimacies at the other. It is possible, as we often observe, for two people to go through life in a personal relationship, father-son, for example, and never share intimacy, only shifting balances of power. The same is true for business partners who never become pals and strangers who never become lovers. Feelings run deepest at the personal level. This is why dramas of personal catastrophe have greater impact than tales of social conflict. Compare Macbeth to Coriolanus, Othello to The Winter's Tale, King Lear to Julius Caesar. With each close friend, relative, or lover, a character evolves a version of himself that he could not bring out all on his own. If intimacy ends, he not only loses a loved one, he loses the version of himself that she inspired. To extend the method of character enrichment I just used at the physical and social levels, I'll add complexity to three characters by contradicting a trait of characterization with a pattern of intimate behavior. Generous versus selfish. Imagine a waiter working for tips who sends thoughtfully inscribed cards to everyone in his family on every birthday and holiday, who bakes far more cookies than necessary so he can share them by the dozen with neighborhood friends, who drifts from heartbreaking love affair to heartbreaking love affair in search of his dream lover. To everyone who knows him, he's an idealistic, people-loving saint. Then he wins the lottery. A saint would donate his Mega Millions to charity, but this character gives nothing to anyone. He banks it all, moves to a warmer clime, and lives like royalty. When he baked cookies, sent cards, and slept around, he was greedy for love. Now that he is rich, this ex-waiter finally gets what he always wanted, people sucking up to him. Supportive versus subversive. Picture a husband who does everything for his wife, shop and cook, fold the laundry, and record her favorite shows. He listens patiently to her complaints and never complains in return. His characterization convinces his wife that he loves her, and so she naturally loves him in return. At parties, however, after a couple of drinks, he tells amusing tales about his wife that implicitly belittle her. He then ends each sly insult with a cheery, "Isn't that right, sweetheart?" Everyone who hears his anecdotes knows that he thinks his wife is a fool. She, however, only nods and smiles. He wounds her and then forces her to show love in return by tagging his attacks with "sweetheart." Guilt versus forgiveness. Imagine a hard-working careerist who takes his frustrations out on his children, abuse after abuse. Then, one day, he tells them that his doctor diagnosed him at risk for a stress-induced heart attack. Nonetheless, he continues to work day and night, so the kids have to forgive his malice and admire his courage. Better still, if he does not tell anyone about his pending coronary and eventually collapses on the job, his kids are forced to love his stoic sacrifice. Either way, his suffering vindicates his cruelty and his children forgive his past abuse. As you labor over a character in the making, any pair of positive-negative adjectives that comes to mind could inspire a dimension. Hard-soft, sweet-sour, calm-hyper are three quick examples. Inner dimensions. Quote, "The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell a hell of heaven," unquote. That's John Milton from Paradise Lost. All outer dimensions, physical, social, personal, trace their roots back to the mind that gave them birth. As a result, complex characters tend to pull the storytelling inside themselves until their inner conflicts become more important, more fascinating than their outer struggles. This is true even when a character's inner conflicts finally burst into violence. Two examples: Raskolnikov in Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, and Catherine in Alice Birch's screenplay for Lady Macbeth. As a writer works to fit a complex character to events, and events to a complex character, the turning points that matter most take place below the surface. The author peers beneath the character's words and gestures, searching behind his eyes, drawn to his churning psychology, trying to puzzle out the inner effects of what outwardly happens. He may discover that his story's external events cause internal reactions that send his character on an arc of change that alters his nature for better or worse. He becomes stronger or weaker, more childish or mature, more fulfilled or emptied out. Interest in the hows and whys of this inner evolution leads the writer's imagination to enter the character's core self, and from this subjective point of view, invent new events that will enhance and express the character's evolving nature. Changes in event design lead to further explorations of inner character. Changes in inner character lead to a reinvention of events, and on the process goes. Pensive minds like Shakespeare's Hamlet and Virginia Woolf's Clarissa Dalloway suffer what today we term cognitive dissonance. They flail in the chasm between thought and action. Their minds rage with an inner turmoil of memories, longings, night and day fantasies, streaming conscious and semi-conscious anxieties over acting or not acting, sorting the real from the unreal, the true from the false, until their final choice is carried out in a single action. More often than not, the spark of contradiction that ignites a dimension comes from the negative side of human nature, the side people hide, but writers excavate. These primal sources of character complexity flow from two inner levels: thought-driven contradictions vying in the conscious mind, and wordless conflicts warring in the subconscious. Conscious conflicts. Depending on his depth of self-awareness, a complex character thinks about, or to some degree senses, his inner incongruities and the disruptions they cause. In his private realm, he knows that sometimes he sees the truth of things, at other times he's blind to the obvious. Sometimes he's kind, at other times cruel. In most cases, he tries to resolve these contradictions, or at least get them under control. Some private dimensions operate at the thinking level and connect two opposed qualities, such as intelligent, unintelligent, curious, incurious, or imaginative, unimaginative. Other paradoxes come from more sentient dimensions, such as impulsive, reflective, angry, calm, and courageous, timid, that give a role emotional complexity. Many social institutions were invented specifically to address one of these inner conflicts. Alcoholics Anonymous copes with the craving, spurning mind of the addicted. Buddhism calms the chronic worrier's past-future frets, what Buddhists call the monkey mind, frantic images and words screeching and swinging from idea to idea, flinging thought feces at mental walls. Let's sketch a couple examples of inner contradiction in the private realm. We'll start, once again, with a trait and contradict it into a dimension. Less versus more. Imagine a character who asks for nothing and lives a quiet life of less. Because he wants nothing, he lacks the focused desire of a protagonist. Now, suppose an experience were to inspire in him a desire to expand outwardly into the noisy life of more. An inner contradiction could take hold between his wish to be celebrated and his need to stay hidden, between his impulse to express himself and his fear of exposure. With these dimensions, he could now star in his own story, as does Arthur Less in Less, a novel by Andrew Sean Greer. This contradiction between the need for less and the need for more, between inner and outer lives, anchors Shakespeare's most complex character, Hamlet. When Hamlet looks outward, trying to change the public world for the better, the corruption he finds disgusts him. When he looks inward, trying to change his inner world for for the better. The paralysis, he finds, also disgusts him. He is withdrawn, yet theatrical, consumed with grief, yet flamboyant with wit, hyper-aware of his inner self, yet blind to his effect on others. An intellect without a strategy, an unstable self in search of an identity. Because both his inner and outer worlds seem meaningless, he verges on madness. Belief versus skepticism. Beliefs treat illusions as truths. Commonly held ideas such as human beings are more good than evil, the Constitution embodies the perfect political system, God rules the universe, and my people are superior to your people, unify a society. When reality finally drags an illusion into the light, public belief withers, unity fractures, and people revolt. In the aftermath of revolution, however, society regroups around a more credible illusion and builds institutions to replace an old belief with a new fallacy. Understanding this cycle, novelist Joseph Conrad divided his characters into two types, idiots and convicts. Idiots believe in illusions and enslave themselves to these ideas. Conradian idiots become heroes and nemeses, super patriots and super villains. Convicts see illusions for what they are, comforting deceptions that protect us from an indifferent, hostile, chaotic universe. To a Conradian convict, action seems pointless. They often become the passive, reactive characters of pensive films, plays, and novels. The writer's problem becomes this. A belief inspires something worth doing. Stories put beliefs into action. A character void of belief can only pose like a statue. Imagine, for example, a chronic skeptic who thinks beliefs are for fools. He trusts no one and nothing. He never acts, he only scoffs. Sardonic wit is his sole trait. This convict might make an amusing sidekick or subject for a short story, but he hasn't the heft to carry a full-length telling. A story's spine of action needs a lightning charge of belief to animate action. So to prepare a skeptic for his story, give him a belief. To add complexity, contradict it. You could, for example, test his views about the supernatural. Does he believe in the existence of a supreme being or not? As a cynic, he's probably an agnostic who believes that the only logical position on the question of God's existence is to doubt both theism and atheism. On that point, he's unshakable until he falls in love with a believer and begins to doubt his doubt. What will he finally believe or not believe? Whichever way it turns, he's now an interesting man with story potential. Each of these examples explored just one dominant dimension, but multiple inner contradictions can easily coexist in the same character, as they did in Odysseus and Tony Soprano. Indeed, a modern writer's ambition for the long-form, 100-hour screen series demands characters of seemingly inexhaustible dimensionality so that 5 years after their debut, they still amaze audiences with hitherto unrevealed dynamics. The list of conflicting contradictions in human consciousness seems endless. Think of any adjective imagine its opposite, and you have the beginning of a character dimension. Independent, dependent. Neuroticism, stability. Extroversion, introversion. Agreeableness, disagreeableness. Open to experience, closed to experience. Conscientiousness, carelessness. And on it goes. The only limit is your imagination. Conscious versus subconscious conflict. When talking about the innermost self, I prefer the term subconscious to unconscious. To me, the un in unconscious suggests an inert, coma-like state, mindless as a rock. In fact, this deepest realm is an active, cognitive subconscious. Sub simply means below consciousness. During the night, the subconscious rises into mindfulness, disguised inside symbolic objects and irrational storylines of dreams. Throughout the day, however, the hidden self stays unknown and unheard, busily driving the desires that consciousness puts into action. Because the core self is unaware of this process, a character believes he guides his own life. In fact, he is not in command. An alien hidden self also occupies him. As Freud said, "The manifestations I notice in myself, but do not know how to link up with the rest of my mental life, seem to belong to another person." The conscious and subconscious aspects of the mind are Janus-faced, inseparable, conflicted, and overlapping. Where does the subconscious end and the conscious begin? When does a character become aware of his subconscious desires? When does a conscious habit sink into the unthinking and instinctive? No clear line separates the two. In the sections that follow, I hold these inner realms apart to illustrate the principles of character design. In your work to create multidimensional roles, however, you will have to draw that line specifically, character by character. Confronting antisocial, often violent, subconscious impulses is the primary moral struggle for almost every complex character you create. Embracing the hidden self's dark heart, as well as its halo of light, is essential to self-knowledge. Light, of course, is easy to see. Making darkness visible takes courage. When a story's inciting incident throws the life of a complex character out of balance, two desires appear simultaneously. One, a conscious object of desire, a specific thing or situation that he feels would restore balance. Two, a subconscious, nascent desire that has lain undisturbed for years stirs to life. The conscious object of desire. Everyone wants reasonable control over their existence and the events that impact it. When an inciting incident throws life out of kilter, the desire to restore equilibrium naturally arises within a protagonist. What he must do to achieve this rebalance may be unclear at first, but sooner or later, he will conceive of his object of desire, something he believes has the power to put his life back on its feet. Depending on the genre, his object of desire could be a physical thing, such as a dead monster in a horror film like Splinter. A situation such as a family reunion in a domestic drama like The Corrections by Jonathan Franzen, or an experience such as a spiritual transformation, as in an evolution plot like The Razor's Edge by W. Somerset Maugham. In the vast majority of stories, the protagonist's conscious pursuit of an object of desire is sufficient to carry the telling. The subconscious object of desire. When a deeply conflicted, complex protagonist begins pursuit of his object of desire, his subconscious often comes into play as well and adds a counter-desire. The subconscious has its own wants and knows what steps to take. As a result, the inciting incident also provokes a subconscious drive, a hidden hunger that seeks its own object of desire, one that will satisfy a long-dormant, unrecognized wish or grievance. This subconscious desire contradicts the protagonist's conscious desire, making the character, in many ways, his own worst enemy. A nascent counter-desire rarely, if ever, focuses on a physical object alone. Once again, depending on the genre, his counter-desire could be either a situation, such as the domination of an older sibling in a domestic drama, like the Skyler Marie subplot in Breaking Bad, or an experience such as a transcendent, life-fulfilling romance in a love story, like The Bridges of Madison County. If a character's conscious and subconscious desires are the same, hungry, he opens his refrigerator, horny, he masturbates, depressed, he calls a friend, they add neither complexity nor depth. Why give a character a subconscious desire if it just happens to be the same thing he wants consciously? Who would notice? But if these two desires contradict each other, if his subconscious desire blocks and reverses his conscious will, then things get interesting. Psychologists, from William James to Jacques Lacan, have argued that the subconscious is a contra mirror of its conscious cousin. For writers, reverse reflection has been common knowledge for centuries. For a subconscious desire to draw the interest of a reader audience, it must directly contradict or sharply contrast with the character's conscious hopes and longings. Then people notice with interest. An exact balance of power between a character's conscious and subconscious selves is up to the writer to strike. Neither dismiss it cynically as animal instinct, nor smugly treat it as a mechanical calculation. Love versus hate. Consider the dimension that contradicts love with hate. Jules Pfeiffer's screenplay for Carnal Knowledge spans the life of Jonathan First, played by Jack Nicholson, from his college days to middle age. If we were to ask Jonathan what he wants out of life, his conscious answer would be, "I'm a good-looking, fun-loving financial success. My life would be paradise if I could just find the perfect woman to share it." Over the decades, he meets woman after woman, all attractive, all intelligent, all loving, but every affair falls into the same pattern. A beautifully amorous beginning, a bitter, boring middle, an ugly, humiliating breakup. In the wreckage of romance, each woman finds herself abandoned. Jonathan's dominant dimension follows the tradition set by Don Juan and Vicomte de Valmont, the woman-hating romantic. Consciously, he tells himself that he gave a lifetime of love to women, and yet they, for various reasons, always broke his heart. Subconsciously, he loathed each and every one. Every year, he seduced a woman into adoration. Then once he trapped her in that vulnerable place, he systematically crushed the heart out of her. The conscious desire to love and the subconscious urge to hate have coexisted since monogamy. Fear versus courage. Action writers work along a spectrum that runs from life-risking action to paralyzed terror. When a dimension connects these two extremes, the result is genuine heroism. Fear is an instinctive reaction to the threat of death, followed by an impulse to flee. Courage is a deliberate choice to risk death, followed by an action against the threat. Absolute fear begins in the subconscious and ultimately takes full control of a coward. Absolute courage begins in a conscious choice and drives an action hero. Superheroes such as Spider-Man and Wolverine build a character around one fantastic dimension, often fusing the human with the mythical, animal, magical, or pseudoscientific. Crime fighters such as John McClane or Dirty Harry Callahan cluster a characterization of true-to-life yet cool traits into a romanticized tough guy. Both types exhibit superlative, self-sacrificial, courageous altruism on behalf of the victimized. But nothing from their interior ever contradicts anything on their exterior. Complex heroes, such as Henry Fleming in Stephen Crane's novel The Red Badge of Courage, or Richard Phillips, played by Tom Hanks in Captain Phillips, pit their conscious moral strength against a fear-soaked subconscious. In other words, unlike the idealized calm of an action hero, the mind of a realistic hero does not disconnect the conscious from the subconscious. Rather, the character makes decisions to take life-risking actions while simultaneously gripped by fear. Conflicts within the subconscious. Readers and audiences perceive subconscious dimensions by implication. They compare what a character says with what he does. They match the reasons and rationalizations he gives others against the actual choices and actions he takes in the world. When they spot an inconsistency, they sense a clash of forces at work behind his eyes, fears skulking in the darkness versus angers aimed at the world. These deepest of all wars pit two irreconcilable hungers against each other. Ineffable subconscious conflicts, invisible to the character, but glimpsed by the reader audience, then push and pull through the story. Portraying these hidden primal conflicts may be the most difficult work that ever confronts an author. Novelists and short story writers often use an omniscient third-person narrator to describe a character's psychic tensions directly to the reader. Screenwriters and playwrights also use this device, but rarely. Of the two kinds of storytellers, those who explain and those who imply, I prefer the latter. Self versus other. The lower brain obeys two imperatives: protect yourself and protect your gene pool. In the balance, the life force feels that the second duty is more important than the first. For this reason, parents sacrifice themselves for their children, soldiers die for their country, and believers strap on dynamite vests to kill non-believers. The choice between self and genes may seem irrational at times, but it drove the evolution of life on our planet. Consequently, the most persistent, virtually daily conflict waged within the subconscious mind is self-love versus other love. As a famous example, consider Robert Benton's screenplay for Kramer versus Kramer. Ted Kramer, played by Dustin Hoffman, begins the story as a self-absorbed, immature workaholic whose wife labors as a stay-at-home mom for his son while playing surrogate mother to him. Her sudden abandonment of both throws Kramer's self-content life radically out of balance. This negative turning point arouses within Kramer a previously suppressed, never-acted-upon need, the subconscious longing to be a mensch, a loving human being. His son's well-being becomes far more important than his own. At the climax, he acts to forfeit his needs for his son's. Illusion versus delusion. Another conflict that could arise in the subconscious concerns a character's processing of reality, the difference between illusion and delusion. An illusion is belief in a false perception, such as a mirage, a phantom limb, or faith in the impossible. A delusion is a rigid belief in a false reality, a symptom typical of mental disorder. In the backstory of A Streetcar Named Desire, Tennessee Williams' protagonist, Blanche DuBois, pursued girlhood illusions of romantic love into a ruinous marriage, loss of her family's estate, and secret years as a prostitute. Despite it all, she held on to her princess illusions and fantasized an ideal life to come. Finally, under extremes of alcohol, humiliation, and sexual violence, her self-deceptions collapse into total delusion and an asylum for the insane. Absurdist farces, such as Edward Albee's A Delicate Balance aside, characters beset with dimensions of subconscious contradiction often end in death or madness. Case study: Antony and Cleopatra. For two examples of how dimensions on multiple levels crisscross in a complex character, consider Shakespeare's magnificent lovers, Antony and Cleopatra. Antony's prime dimension pits his social self against his hidden self, his command of the Roman Empire versus his lust for the Queen of Egypt. Or, put another way, a conflict between conscious reason and subconscious drive. Antony's political self pushes his reputation to its furthest reaches, while his inner self craves carnality at its most intense. This clever, articulate, pragmatic, proud general is not confused about the politics of Rome. Antony knows what he ought to do. But he's also a pleasure-loving, beauty-obsessed, love-sick fool. His hunger for Cleopatra drives what he wants to do. And, as noted, the difference between ought and want is all the difference in the world. To further enrich Antony's nature, Shakespeare added numerous contradictions over a wide range of behaviors. When he's on the world stage, he roars in the rugged, heedless voice of a warrior general. When he lounges with Cleopatra, he speaks with the kiss-soaked, caressing voice of a poet. He commands legions, yet enslaves himself to a woman. He's an adult at the head of his armies, an adolescent at the feet of his beloved. He is willful on the battlefield, will-less in Cleopatra's bed. If we look into the heart of Antony, we may see that for him, war and love are just two versions of passion and pleasure. As people who love war will tell you, killing is a passion and victory a deep pleasure. In the film Patton, for example, when General George Patton surveys the carnage of the dead and bleeding soldiers on a smoldering battlefield, he whispers, "God help me, but I love it so." The same words he might whisper in a midnight passion. Cleopatra is one of Shakespeare's most complex characters. She's a royal decadent, an innocent enchantress. She's courageous in the face of her enemies, yet panic-driven in war. She is a non-stop actress who fills her performances with such truth of feeling no one ever doubts her. In fact, men find her so alluring that what in other women would be defects and vices, in her become perfections and virtues. Her vicious anger becomes aristocratic command. Her wild wailings become tears of sorrow. Her immature clowning becomes charming humor. Her drunkenness becomes queenly celebration. Her nagging becomes concern for Antony. Her begging and bargaining become humility and reasonableness. Her bad jokes become wit. Her wanton sexuality becomes charisma. Her limitless ego and vanity get reinterpreted into patriotism and love of country. Cleopatra's genius is this. When forces of rage, greed, and lust arise from her subconscious, her perceptive mind captures them before they can reach the world and converts them into entrancing, persuasive performances. What her lover, her enemies, her subjects see is not darkness, but greatness. As a result, her core dimension mirrors Antony's, shrewd, willful, calculating ambition versus foolish, weak-willed surrender to passion. Some define tragedy as never getting what you want. Others suggest that true tragedy gives you exactly what you want at its full price. Character conflict in depth. We often think of characters as if they were containers. We package their qualities inside spatial modifiers such as round and flat. We label the incurious as square, bores as shallow, bigots as narrow, while a mind open to new ideas seems broad. And perhaps the most common person as a vessel allusion, deep. These adjectives serve as conversational shorthand, but to invent an intriguing, multidimensional role, an author takes the measure of a soul. By what gauge does someone seem full or empty? How can a writer sound the depths of character? Human beings have an inborn echo device that pings into play the moment they meet someone. This instantaneous instinct needs no thought. It knows it when it sees it. Our subconscious sonar quickly tracks signs in the face, hears tremors in the voice, senses tensions in gestures, then looks behind the eyes to plumb the inner energies of a human vessel. This sounding of depth has a name: first impression. The first impression instinct evolved to answer the question, can I trust this person? The answer was, and still is, a key to survival. Characters that readers and audiences instinctively trust and admire over time tend to have inner dimensions reaching into their private and hidden selves. This sense of depth encourages empathy and trust. What follows are 10 traits associated with the depth of character, followed by examples taken from stage, screen, and page. If your storytelling ambitions call for characters of complexity and depth, this list should spur your imagination. 1. Ironic self-awareness. He is always on guard against self-deception and rarely fooled by what goes on inside his own mind. Example: Claire Underwood, played by Robin Wright, in Beau Willimon's long-form series House of Cards. 2. Insight into others. He is always aware of public pretensions and never fooled by what goes on inside society. Example: Madame Merrill and Henry James's The Portrait of a Lady. 3. Intelligence. He can think. He gathers knowledge from all disciplines and commands the logic that puts it to work. Example: Miss Marple in 12 novels and 20 short stories by Agatha Christie. 4. A History of Suffering. As Aeschylus wrote in the Oresteia, even in our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart until, in our own despair, against our will, through the terrible grace of God, comes wisdom. Although a character wishes for happiness, he finds depth through suffering. The happy mind thinks about life's benefits. The suffering mind sinks deeper into itself. Suffering takes a character beneath his routines to discover that he is not who he thought he was. Losing a loved one smashes through the floor of the core self, revealing a deeper level. Grief then smashes through that floor, revealing yet greater depth. Try as people may, they cannot tell themselves to stop feeling pain. Suffering gives them a more accurate sense of their limitations, what they can and cannot control. Pain propels a callow mind into maturity. The wise response places anguished experience in a moral context and redeems something bad by turning it into something precious. In short, a deep soul has witnessed pain, caused pain, and lived with the guilt. Example: Mike Ehrmantraut, played by Jonathan Banks in Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, risks his life in crime after crime to provide a future for his granddaughter. 5. Broad experience over time. A young character may seem wise beyond his years, but, in truth, depth needs wide-ranging experience and, above all, time. Example, Claudia Hampton in Penelope Lively's novel Moon Tiger. 6. Focused attention. Face to face, he listens intently, makes eye contact, and reads subtext. Example, Don Vito Corleone, played by Marlon Brando and Robert De Niro, in The Godfather and The Godfather Part 2. 7. Love of beauty. Depth sharpens his sensitivity until beauty is almost painful. Example, Aaliyah Sobey in An Unnecessary Woman by Rabi Alameddine. 8. Calm. No matter the threat or stress, he keeps his passions under control. Example, Captain Augustus Gus McCrae, played by Robert Duvall, in Larry McMurtry's miniseries Lonesome Dove, which was based on his novel. 9. Cynic and skeptic. Hope, he believes, is the denial of reality. He doesn't trust anything anyone says until he tests it against his own mind. Example, Mama Nadi in Ruined by playwright Lynn Nottage. 10. A searcher for meaning. He gets God's joke. He knows life has no intrinsic meaning, so he searches for one somewhere in the gap between living for yourself and living for others. Example, Benna Carpenter in Laurie Moore's novel Anagrams. Roll these traits into one role, and they often create an anti-hero. A loner hardened by bad luck, but vulnerable to the suffering of others. A stoic amused by his own suffering. Sharp-witted in public, self-mocking when alone. Cynical about society's rules, committed to a personal code. A romantic, wary of romance. All 10 traits embedded themselves in Sam Spade, in The Maltese Falcon, in Rick Blaine, in Casablanca, and Philip Marlowe in The Big Sleep, who were portrayed to perfection 3 times over by Humphrey Bogart. Few actors since have been tested to that depth. Denzel Washington, first among the best. Life in the subtext. Text, a character's outer behavior in word and action. These verbal and physical expressions stimulate images in a reader's imagination or strike the eye and ear of an audience. Together, they create his characterization. Subtext, a character's thoughts and feelings that are conscious but unexpressed, as well as subconscious and thus inexpressible. The core self plies these ideas and attitudes within himself and to no one else, while at the deepest level of subtext, his ineffable moods and desires pulse below his awareness. Minor characters are text only. These roles serve a story by acting out exactly who they seem to be. The writer deliberately denies them depth and an inner life worth knowing. A major character, on the other hand, is not who he seems. His text of characterization masks the mystery of his core self, alive and in the subtext. His implicit inner life intrigues readers and audiences, sparking the question, who is this character really? The scent of subtext invites them to explore and unearth the truth of this unknown self. In short, a beautifully conceived and executed multidimensional character turns readers and audiences into psychics. Think about your own story-going hours. When you follow a character's life, turning pages of prose or sitting in a dark theater, don't you often have the distinct impression that you're reading minds, reading emotions? Your perceptions seem to travel beneath their behaviors, and you think to yourself, I know what's really going on inside that character better than he knows. I can see from the surface to the substance of what he's really thinking, really feeling, and really wanting, consciously and subconsciously. You gain these insights on your own, as you must, because, as in life, depth can only be intuited. This is why two people experiencing the same character often come away with very different interpretations. The subtextual someone living inside a complex role can never be fully explained in words, no matter who writes them. No one can tell you what to think about a character, not even the character himself in his most heartfelt confessions. The godlike omniscient narrators of the greatest of novels imply more than they ever tell, leave far more unsaid than said. This is why the archives of libraries stack thousands of works of literary criticism, all asking who questions. Who is Hamlet? Who is Anna Karenina? Who is Walter White? The partition of text and subtext, what the world sees in the outer self versus the truth concealed behind the eyes, is essential to sanity. If the invasive world cannot be kept safely outside the mind, the inner life becomes unlivable. Like readers and audiences, characters themselves peer into the subtextual depths of each other, trying to discover a hidden truth. Can I believe him? What does he really mean, really want? Who does he care about, himself or others? And on it goes as each character reads the subtext of the others. Othello must discover if his wife is virtuous. Lear must discover which daughter, if any, loves him. Hamlet must discover if his uncle murdered his father, and finally does so by reading Claudio's guilty reaction to a murder scene played out on stage. Introspective characters rerun personal experiences as if they were TV episodes, searching through their subtexts, analyzing their actions, trying to figure out who they really are and how they got that way. Sometimes the self-reflective mind uncovers hidden insights, learns from mistakes, and increases self-awareness. At other times, it obsesses over its failures, doubts its worth, and blinds itself to the truth. Three examples. The self-absorbed, self-narrating protagonists of the novels A Fan's Notes by Frederick Exley, The Sea, the Sea by Iris Murdoch, and The Woman Upstairs by Claire Massoud.